Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
You are listening to Real College Podcast, and I'm your host, Jacob. This week, we're taking inspiration from This American Life. A few weeks back, they did an episode called Things I Mean to Know, and so this week, our reporters are taking a look at a lot of things that we've always been curious about. And if you are as confused about Bitcoin as I am, then this is the episode for you. That starts right now on Real College Podcast. Some things we mean to know are harder to find out than others. The how and why of U-Haul's side panel decorations, also known as super graphics, is one of those things. Liv Riggins looks into what super graphics are and why they exist.
Moving trucks are familiar to pretty much everyone. As one of the most popular brands in North America, U-Hauls have become almost synonymous with moving. With their massive popularity, everyone's seen plenty of them. But have you ever really looked at the splashy graphics on the side panels and wondered why that one in particular? I did this summer when my mom brought home a U-Haul with the snakes of Narcissi on it. The graphic shows about 25 hissing snakes in lifelike detail, with a text inset reading, "Did you know, emerging from winter dens, 150,000 red-sided garter snakes begin mating and feeding rituals. What drives one of the world's largest concentrations of vertebrate species to breed in such striking spectacle? Find out at uhaul.com." You know, it's a little odd. Why have that, like, 7 feet by 7 feet on the side of your moving vans? Then on the moving van I got this fall, the Alberta Ice Ship was featured. Also known as Project Habakkuk, it was a World War II project initiated by one of Churchill's personal friends, Jeffrey Pike. It involved building an entire aircraft carrier out of a mix of wood pulp and ice. This was an ill-fated project, as even in icy Canadian waters, the ice in the ship would melt when it came in contact with liquid water. The large amount of wood pulp that would be required was enough to affect paper production significantly. Plus, each ship would require 40,000 tons of cork insulation, thousands of miles of steel tubing for brine circulation, and 4 power stations. And for all those resources, Habakkuk would be capable of traveling at only 6 knots, less than a quarter of the speed of your average cruise ship. Pike didn't stop there, though. He also proposed creating 6-foot-wide tubes which would propel soldiers and supplies by water power from ship to land in shallow waters or in hostile territories. Essentially, massive water slides. He worked out some rough ideas for supplying the passengers with oxygen and suggested that the problem of claustrophobia might be ameliorated by traveling in pairs and by the judicious use of barbiturate drugs. Basically, a drug-fueled water slide adventure. However, this whole scheme wouldn't work without infrastructure to build the massive pipes and roads to carry the supplies, which would first have to be constructed in enemy territory. He also suggested creating a railroad train powered by human cyclists, though this was also never adopted. So, a pretty wild guy, but why does U-Haul care about promoting snake pits and wild inventors? According to U-Haul's press release, Super Graphics program came into being as a medium to recognize and honor each state and province. Quite simply, Super Graphics are our way of giving back to the communities we serve, giving thanks and paying tribute to North American communities. We could sell this space to corporate America, but U-Haul believes we must give something back to the communities we serve. To this end, we say, thank you, North America, for the mysteries you've revealed to us. So maybe it's just kind of a PR thing. But apparently U-Haul puts a lot of effort into this, even hiring actual academics and scientists to research and put together the text for the panels. You can also go online and access websites for each of the 50 states and 13 provinces, and these sites go really in-depth. Just looking at the Snakes of Narcissi website, there's 16 different tabs with extensive descriptions on all aspects of the snake's behavior, as well as info on how to visit the snake pits. There's also an interactive puzzle for kids. Plus, each website has a different theme that matches the topic. For the ghost ship of Nova Scotia, it's an ocean background with the fiery ship flickering, and information is displayed on rolling scrolls. For the Alberta ice boat, it's a World War II-style file folder with actual blueprints and pictures of the ship scattered around the desk image that serves as the background. It seems like there's really a lot of work put into this. So maybe it's still just a very complex PR stunt, but maybe U-Haul actually cares. It's half family owned, and the CEO, one of the sons of the founder, has put his personal cell phone number out for troubled U-Haul renters to contact him directly. At the same time, it's not really clear why U-Haul would care specifically about snake pits, ice boats, a misdefined stone structure in New Jersey, the carnivorous plants of North Carolina's Green Swamp Preserve, or Michigan's 37-acre humongous fungus. In researching this, I think I generated more questions than answers. At any rate, I'm glad U-Haul does seem to care about this. It adds some mystery and delight to an otherwise very mundane process. For Radio K's Real College Podcast, I'm Liv Riggins.
Growing up Puerto Rican in mainland USA meant that I was taught US history and there was very little mention of the tiny island of Puerto Rico. I didn't really think too much about it until I started hearing Puerto Rican artists like Princess Nokia and Hooray for the Riff Raff's Alienda Segarra mention the Young Lords. A very basic Google search revealed to me that the Young Lords Party was an activist group of mainly Puerto Ricans that formed in the 70s. How in the world had I never heard of them before? That's when I reached out to Daryl Wanzer Serrano.
I am an associate professor of rhetoric and public advocacy in the Department of Communication Studies at the University of Iowa.
Daryl wrote a book called The New York Young Lords and the Struggle for Liberation. Like me, Serrano grew up not knowing too much about his Puerto Rican history, but always valuing that part of himself.
It was supposed to be my last semester of coursework in my PhD program, and I had a professor who encouraged me to research something having to do with my Puerto Rican heritage, and she was the first professor to really do that for me.
Daryl picked up an anthology on Puerto Rico and found some writing from the Young Lords.
By the end of the semester, I had made the decision to do a dissertation on a new topic and to extend my coursework and really kind of start transforming my life in a lot of ways.
The Young Lords started out as a street gang that became political under the guidance of Jose Chacha Jimenez.
They stood for a lot of things. I mean, they were a grassroots street political organization that organized around the issues that were most important to the people in their community. So in New York City, those issues included garbage. That was the very first issue they organized around, was the lack of kind of trash pickup in East Harlem.
One of the most memorable things the Young Lords did as a party was testing the water for lead. They knew that the government had these lead testing kits, but they weren't doing the work to help the people, so the Young Lords decided to take it upon themselves. They picked up the kits and went door to door testing the water for lead. When I heard this, my first thought was that they reminded me a lot of the Black Panthers, and in some ways they are kind of like that.
The Black Panthers were definitely an organization that the Young Lords looked to for inspiration, looked to for kind of guidance on how to structure some of the things that they were doing and how to put in place some of the programs that they put in place.
They even followed the business model of the Black Panthers. The Black Panthers paid for their organization by producing a magazine called The Panther. The Young Lords had their own magazine called Palante. When you look at what they were fighting for, the groups diverged, though.
They were their own organization and identity. I mean, they weren't just trying to be the Puerto Rican version of the Black Panther Party. They weren't born of quite the same struggle against, even though they faced issues and dealt with issues of police brutality, they weren't organized from the beginning around that issue in the same way that the Black Panthers were.
One of the things the Young Lords was fighting for was independence for Puerto Rico. In this march, you can hear that they're telling Puerto Ricans to wake up so that they realize the oppression that they're facing. Another thing that set the group apart was the kind of art that was being produced by them. Many of their members were poets and writers, which is evident in copies of their magazines Palante. One of the pieces in the magazine talks about the solidarity between movements, saying, Mi lucha es tuya, tu lucha es mía. Lo que importa es calor, valor y mucha camaradería. Which translates to, My struggle is your struggle is mine. What matters is the heat, courage, and lots of camaraderie. With so much rich history and art, I find it crazy that I'd never really heard or learned about the Young Lords before. I learned about the Black Panthers in school, but never the Young Lords. I asked Daryl about it. He said one of the big things is that the records weren't kept well. While writing this book, he had to go to New York and scan most of the copies of Parante himself. Another reason that the Young Lords may not be as widely known is because of the ambiguity of Puerto Rican race. Compare it to something like Black Lives Matter.
When you have groups of people who are making a claim to black life, right, that tends to kind of stick in the national imaginary in a certain kind of way.
Puerto Ricans are hard to pin down. Racially, we exist in a space sort of between black and white, so studying us can be a difficult thing. Daryl says there also just aren't a lot of Puerto Ricans who go into academia and study this kind of stuff. But for him, studying this was life-changing.
My Puerto Rican identity had been an important part of my life, at least the way that I would label my life. But really, like, coming into contact with that that piece from The Young Lords, where, you know, it's written from someone who was roughly, you know, similar age to me at that time in my life, you know, in their kind of early 20s, late teens, coming to a kind of political consciousness at that moment, it really started kind of mirroring where I saw myself in my life. And so it was transformative in the sense that I was, for the first time, really seeing a bit of myself in something that I was reading about.
And although the Young Lords Party doesn't exist the way it used to, it's still influencing many young Puerto Ricans across the country. For Real College Podcast, I'm Jacob Maldonado Medina. It's been a big year for Bitcoin. Since January, Bitcoin's value has risen from $960 to $14,600. That's an increase of more than 1,000%. Alongside this price increase, Bitcoin has received a lot of coverage in the press, as well as increased mainstream acceptance. NASDAQ, the world's second largest stock exchange, plans to introduce a market in Bitcoin futures by the second quarter of next year. Bitcoin's swift rise can be a little surprising if, like many people, you're not exactly sure what a Bitcoin actually is. To find out, Real College Podcast recorder Ben Hallam sat down with Justin Ehrenhofer, the co-president of the University of Minnesota's Cryptocurrency Club.
Suppose you have an online banking account like most people do now, and they send money to pay bills and so forth. They aren't physically sending cash anymore. It's all done electronically. With Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies in general, it kind of takes this a step further. Instead of relying on centralized entities like your bank in order to process this transaction for you, you actually rely on computers all over the world to process this transaction. And so you just tell the network that you would like to send money to one person. It's recorded through thousands of computers around the world, and then it's verified by thousands of other computers around the world. And so you have a situation where you can still transfer money, but in this case, it's you directly sending money to them through this distributed system instead.
How does this distributed system work? What types of computers make up the network? And how do they secure Bitcoin transactions?
Okay, so there are really two types of computers that process this information. So first are called nodes. These store a history of all the transactions that have ever taken place. These transactions are grouped together into blocks. These blocks contain the most recent 10 minutes of transactions for Bitcoin, and then every 10 minutes they'll just keep adding on these blocks, and collectively these blocks form the blockchain, which is just the history of all the transactions that have ever happened. The second component are miners. These are the ones that actually secure the network. So you have a lot of computers competing against each other to see who will actually solve this next block, to see who can actually verify these transactions. It's a bunch of computers basically solving a guess and check problem. And since there is a lot of competition and no one controls it, it's uncertain who will actually solve this problem, and that's actually what keeps it secure.
How does the process of solving these blocks create new Bitcoin for the miners?
So with Bitcoin, you have a set algorithm with how new coins are created, and miners are incentivized to actually participate in the first place based off this reward. You'll have a new block, and in this case, suppose that it's indicated that there will be 10 more Bitcoin generated this block. The person who solves this will get that 10 Bitcoin and any fees that they collect when processing the transactions.
Who is mining for Bitcoin, and what sort of equipment do they need?
With mining, specifically with Bitcoin, people typically use specialized hardware. It's called an ASIC, a special computer that is very good at doing one thing only, mining Bitcoin. But with other cryptocurrencies, it's still possible to mine on your normal CPU, so your normal computer, and many people still mine stuff on GPUs, so with their graphics cards. And these can be run by really anyone. So it's not one entity that's really doing it. Anyone has the opportunity to participate in mining, and it's basically kind of like a race, so you have a chance at a reward to be compensated for actually solving the block.
How has the process of mining Bitcoin changed as the cryptocurrency has gained popularity?
It's definitely been a story of a transition. So with Bitcoin, when it launched, most people, or very few people, knew about it. It could be mined on your normal computer, like your laptop could mine 50 Bitcoin pretty easily, and that's worth tens, hundreds of thousands of dollars now. And it later transitioned to using your graphic card because they were more specialized, and then people eventually developed ASICs to work with this algorithm. Now, if you try to mine Bitcoin with a CPU, it's basically worthless. You can mine for over 10 years and likely not get anything. And that's completely different to when it started off. And if you had an ASIC, you'd just be like miles ahead of other people that are just using non-specialized hardware.
Much of the news coverage surrounding Bitcoin has focused on its rising value, while also questioning how firmly this value is grounded in reality. Do you think Bitcoin's value is going to continue to rise, or are we due for some sort of corrective price fall in the future?
I think in the short term, you're likely to see a correction just because you've seen significant increases over the past several weeks. It's grown from, in a very short period of time, from like $8,000 to $15,000. And so I'm really bad and I don't really like to speculate about long-term prices and so forth. Ultimately, the price of Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies is just based off supply and demand. Like, if more people are willing to buy it than sell it, the price goes up and vice versa. So it is really hard to put a price value to it. Like, for instance, when you're valuing stocks, you typically have revenues and so forth to base off. With cryptocurrencies, it's more of like an idea. So with Bitcoin, the fundamental value that, in my opinion, it provides is just a very high level of security. And so it's very difficult to value these really intangible items. And as such, it's really hard for people to really evaluate it.
Once you've mined a Bitcoin, what can you do with it? Where can you go to buy something with Bitcoin?
Very few merchants actually accept Bitcoin directly. So you have Newegg, you used to have Steam, but they recently stopped accepting Bitcoin just because Bitcoin's transaction fees have grown large. However, there are very easy on and off ramps, so it's very easy to convert Bitcoin back to dollars to spend. And I think that there's still interest in accepting cryptocurrencies in general, but we've just seen very large fees where an average transaction might cost $3 or $4 to send. I think that just speaks partially to a limitation of the efficiency of cryptocurrencies.
What do you see as the future for distributed systems technologies like Bitcoin? Are there any further applications being developed for this technology?
You will see systems built on top of Bitcoin and other privacy systems, because I think that's the clearest advantage you can get out of a decentralized system. But you do see really cool projects too, for example with Ethereum, where you can have the ability to make decentralized applications. So instead of going to a specific website for an individual service, for example like eBay or something, you could theoretically make that distributed so that everyone runs those applications throughout the whole network. For instance, if you wanted to go to eBay, you would connect to their servers and download the website and communicate with them specifically. With Ethereum and decentralized applications and so forth, you communicate with the rest of the nodes in the network. It's kind of like a virtual system that's created throughout all these computers around the world, and you communicate with them instead. And I know there's a lot of interest in the space at trying to develop those items. So you have some promising projects there, and you have even more that aren't very promising. But that's just kind of what you have to deal with in the space now, where everyone's trying to make money, and you need to kind of ignore those that are just trying to scam you.
I'm Ben Helm for Radio K's Real College Podcast. It's
walk into any big-name pharmacy and you're bound to see aisles of pills neatly stacked under the sterile fluorescent lighting. Sometimes the pharmacies come to you, bottles of vitamin D or melatonin behind the bathroom mirror, eons of old Flintstone gummies hidden behind the pastas and saran wraps in the cabinet. But what classifies something as a dietary supplement? According to Professor Dan Gallagher of the Food Sciences and Nutrition Department at the University of Minnesota, the line can be a little bit blurry, but nutritional issues are something that people face every day. Reporter Hannah Dove has the story.
A lot of our chronic health issues in this country have a moderate to strong connection to their nutritional status, to what they've been eating or not eating for a long, long time. And for some of these, it's hard to inspire an 18-year-old to think about something that might affect them when they're 60 years old. Teenagers are not really noted for long-term thinking.
Professor Gallagher, how many years have you worked at the University of Minnesota?
It's been quite a while now. In fact, it's getting to the point that I have been here longer than some of my students have been alive. So I feel like a fossil at some point.
As a professor of nutrition, do you believe that enough people are worried about their nutritional health?
Oh, I don't think people think much about it at all. That's why we have all these nutritionally based problems. That's why so many people have nutritionally related issues.
And that's often why a lot of parents and guardians send off their college kids with dietary supplements. Vitamin C, vitamin D, melatonin, and the like. But do you think that diet plays a larger role, or can you supplement your diet with these dietary vitamins and minerals and make it out okay?
The vitamins and essential minerals, you can overcome that by taking a supplement. We live here in Minnesota, and at this time of year, it's not possible to make vitamin D through exposure to sunlight, so it wouldn't happen. So you can overcome that by taking a vitamin D supplement. But what's really been exciting in the area of nutrition the last 20 years or so has been the recognition that there's a lot of things in food that are not essential in the classical sense that probably have real significant health benefits. And usually the supplements focus on one thing. You know, we'll give you a source of isoflavones, which is something that's present in soy, but they don't have the whole gamut of compounds that would be present in real foods.
Data has shown that there's been a gradual increase of people using dietary supplements. Why do you think this is?
It's a lot easier to pop a multivitamin mineral supplement in the morning than to spend a lot of time thinking about whether your diet's balanced. And what is a balanced diet? That's, even the experts aren't entirely in agreement in that, but it's better than what most people consume now. We do pretty much agree on that, that most people's diets leave a lot to be desired. The level of our nutritional understanding in this country is not very high. And so people partly don't know what to do. They don't really understand what a balanced diet means. What does that involve? I've seen that many times that people just said, well, I don't know how to eat. I was never taught. I have no idea. And unfortunately, that seems to be taught less and less in K through 12 school systems. It was never taught very much or very well, and now it seems to be even less.
On the opposite end of the spectrum, some people are afraid of toxicity and side effects in using dietary supplements. What is your take?
The idea of toxicity is way overblown. Vitamins in general, with a few exceptions, are really very, very non-toxic. To consume excess vitamin D is spectacularly difficult. The Vitamin D is usually sold in what's called international units, IUs. And so the recommendation, which is around 800 international units a day, you can safely, absolutely safely, take 4,000 international units a day and forever and not be concerned. Toxic symptoms have only really shown up at more like 40 to 50,000 international units. The only way you can get that amount is like taking half a bottle a day for long periods of time. The possibility of a deficiency is so much more greater than any possible side effect or toxicity.
Can non-vitamin and mineral supplements such as herbal extracts still be considered dietary supplements?
Well, they are legally considered dietary supplements. And so, I mean, by the fact that you're consuming these and they're not food sort of puts them in the category of dietary supplements. You have to understand about those kinds of compounds is they're very lightly regulated. And so there's not a lot of quality control. Dietary supplements of the kinds that are not vitamin and mineral supplements have been more problematic for sure. And whether they even provide a benefit is been something that's been argued quite a bit. You pay your money and you take your chance. Can't guarantee that if you take a supplement that's like a garlic extract that it's going to do you any good. It depends very much on the individual.
Why are herbal extracts and other non-vitamin and mineral supplements not heavily regulated by the FDA?
Was legislated to be that way. There's, in our field, a famous act, goes by the abbreviation of DSHEA. That basically prohibited regulation of the dietary supplement world. And that was put through by a particular senator whose area of representation, his state, was home to a lot of companies that made dietary supplements. And so that was passed many years ago, and that is the reason why these are lightly supplemented. Prior to that, FDA was trying to clamp down and trying to enforce more rigorous quality control, and basically this law said, hands off, you can't do that. And that is also why they can make some dubious claims sometimes. And FDA can't really do too much about it. So the claims can dance around what they do. You can't say this cures cancer, for example, but you could say this creates a healthy organ system or this creates a healthy heart. You can't say it cures heart disease, but you can say it helps promote a healthy heart. So they've come up with language that gets around the prohibition of stating that it cures a disease, because then it falls into a drug category and they don't want to be regulated as a drug, and they're not drugs.
What makes someone at risk for a vitamin or mineral deficiency?
It will vary a great deal depending on the person themselves, like their physiological state and age, and also where they live in the country in the case of vitamin D.
In summary, what do you think is the most important thing people should know about dietary supplements?
We as nutritionists would always first recommend that you try and improve your diet so that you wouldn't need them in the first place. But we understand that there are situations that make that very difficult. And so I think where I would start in terms of a dietary supplement is with a vitamin and multi-mineral supplement, because it's clear that if you're iron deficient or vitamin D deficient, you can reverse that by taking a dietary supplement that contains those.
With Radio K's Real College Podcast, I'm Hannah Duff.
Is all for this week's episode of Real College Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. You can hear all of our previous episodes at radiok.org/realcollegepodcast. You can also subscribe on iTunes and leave us a rating. Let us know what you think. Real College Podcast is a production of Radio K. It's produced by Alex Schumacher, Emily Allen, and Liv Riggins. I'm your host and managing editor, Jacob Maldonado Medina. Thank you so much for listening, and tune in every Monday at 6:30 for more arts and cultural coverage.